and open arms, and seemed nearly as wise and gentle as her own daddy. Og could be mighty stern, too, when the occasion demanded. One day, Og told Meta to come into the office when Karen was at her dancing lesson. He was pale and excited. "I have just heard from the Red Cross," he said to his wife. "They have all disappeared, completely. No trace. The entire family. I cannot get any information from Germany. I've tried everything."
"What do you think, Og?"
"What is there to think? They've all been put into a concentration camp. Or worse."
"Oh, dear God."
They could not bring themselves to tell Karen that her entire family had disappeared. Karen was suspicious when the letters stopped coming from Germany, but she was too frightened to ask questions. She loved the Hansons and trusted them implicitly. Instinct told her that if they did not mention her family, there was a reason for it. Then, too, a strange thing was happening. Karen missed her family a great deal, but somehow the images of her mother and father seemed to grow dimmer and dimmer. When a child of 8 has been removed from her parents for such a long time, it gets harder and harder to remember. Karen felt bad sometimes that she could not remember more vividly. At the end of a year, she could hardly remember when she was not Karen Hansen and a Dane. Christmas, 1939. There was a war in Europe, and a year had passed since Karen arrived at the Hansen house. Her bell-like voice carried a sweet hymn as Meta played the piano. After the hymns, Karen went to the closet in her room where she had hidden the Christmas present she had made at school. She handed them the package proudly. It bore a label printed in her hand that read, "To Mommy and Daddy, from your daughter, Karen." April 8th, 1940. The night was filled with treachery. A misty dawn brought the chilling sound of marching boots to the frontiers of Denmark. Dawn brought barge after barge of gray helmeted soldiers creeping through fog-filled inlets and canals. The German army moved in silently with robot-like efficiency and dispersed over the length and breadth of Denmark. April 9th, 1940. Karen and her classmates rushed to the window and looked up at a sky black with thundering airplanes, which one by one descended on the Aalborg aerodrome. April 9th, 1940. People rushed into the streets in confusion. "This is the Danish state radio. Today at 4:15, the German army crossed our frontier at Sayed and Krusa." Completely shocked by the lightning stroke and its masterful execution, the Danes clung desperately to their radios to await word from King Christian. Then the proclamation came. Denmark capitulated without firing a shot in her own defense. The crushing of Poland had taught them that resistance was futile. Meta Hansen pulled Karen out of school and packed to flee to Bornholm or some other remote island. Og calmed her and persuaded her to sit and wait it out. It would be weeks, even months, before the Germans got the government functioning. The sight of the swastika and German soldiers opened a flood of memories for Karen, and with them came fear. Everyone was confused these first weeks, but Og remained calm. The German administration and occupation forces made glowing promises. The Danes, they said, were Aryans like themselves. They were indeed little brothers, and the main reason for the occupation was to protect the Danes from Bolsheviks. Denmark, they said, would be allowed to continue to run her own internal affairs. She would become a model protectorate. Thus, after the initial shock had subsided, a semblance of normalcy returned. The venerable King Christian resumed his daily horseback rides from the Amalienborg Palace in Copenhagen. He rode proudly alone through the streets, and his people followed his lead. Passive resistance was the order of the day. Og had been right. Karen returned to school and to her dancing lessons, and life resumed in Aalborg, almost as though nothing had happened. The year of 1941 came, 8 months of German occupation. It was becoming more obvious each day that tension was growing between the Germans and the people of their model protectorate. King Christian continued to irritate the conquerors by snubbing them. The people, too, ignored the Germans as much as they could, or, worse, poked fun at their struttings and laughed at the proclamations. The more the Danes laughed, the angrier the Germans became. Any illusions the Danes had had at the beginning of the German occupation were soon dispelled. There was a place for Danish machinery and Danish food and Danish geography in the German master plan. Denmark was to become another cog in the German war machine. So, with the example of their fellow Scandinavians in Norway before them, the Danes, by the middle of 1941, had established a small but determined little underground. Dr. Werner Best, the German governor of Denmark, favored a policy of moderation for the model protectorate, so long as the Danes cooperated peaceably. The measures against the Danes were mild by comparison to those of other occupied countries. Nonetheless, the underground movement mushroomed. Although the members of the resistance could not hope to take on German troops in combat or to plan for a general uprising, they found a way to unleash their hatred for the Germans. Sabotage. Dr. Werner Best did not panic. He calmly went about organizing Nazi sympathizers among the Danes to combat this new threat. The German-sponsored Hippo Corps became a Danish terrorist gang for punitive action against their own people. Each act of sabotage was answered by an action by the Hippos. As the months and years of German occupation rolled by, Karen Hansen passed her 11th and 12th birthdays in faraway Aalborg, where life seemed quite normal. The reports of sabotage and the occasional sound of gunfire or an explosion were only momentary causes for excitement. Karen began to blossom into womanhood. She felt the first thrills and despairs that come with caring deeply for someone other than parents or a girlfriend. Young Mogens Sorensen, the best soccer player in the school, was Karen's beau, and she was the envy of every other girl. Her dancing ability led her teacher to urge Mette and Ark to let her try out for the Royal Ballet in Copenhagen. She was a gifted child, the teacher said, and seemed to express through dance a sensitivity far beyond her years. At the turn of 1943, the Hansens became more and more uneasy. The Danish underground was in communication with Allied headquarters and was getting out vital information with regard to the location of essential war manufacturing plants and supply depots inside Denmark. They cooperated further by spotting these targets for the British RAF Mosquito bombers. The Hippos and the other German-sponsored terrorists stepped up reprisals. As the activity heightened, Ag began to ponder. Everyone in Aalborg knew of Karen's origin, although no move had as yet been made against the Danish Jews. A sudden break could come. He could be fairly certain, too, that the facts concerning Karen had been relayed to the Germans by the Hippos. At last, Mette and Ag decided to sell their house in Aalborg and move to Copenhagen on the pretext that there was a better position for Ag there and that Karen could receive better instruction in ballet. In the summer of 1943, Ag became affiliated with a law firm in Copenhagen, where they hoped they could become completely anonymous among its million inhabitants. A birth certificate and papers were forged for Karen to prove she was their natural child. Karen said her goodbyes to Mogens Sorensen and suffered the pain of a badly broken heart. The Hansens found a lovely apartment situated on the Sortedams Dosseringen. It was a tree-lined street looking out on the artificial lake and crossed by numerous bridges which led into the old town. Once the strangeness of resettlement had worn off, Karen loved Copenhagen. It was a fairyland on earth. Karen, Ag, and Maximilian would walk for hours and hours to see the wonders of the town. There were so many wonderful places. Around the port, past the statue of the Little Mermaid, along the Langelinie, or through the bursting gardens of the Citadel, or the gardens at the Christiansborg Palace. There were the waterways and the narrow little alleys crammed with ancient five-story brick houses. There were the never-ending streams of bicycles and that wonderful fish market at Gammelstrand, so vast and noisome it put the one in Aalborg to shame. The crown jewel in that fairyland known as Copenhagen was the Tivoli, a maze of whirling lights and rides and theaters and restaurants and miles of flower beds. The children's band and the Weevex restaurant and the fireworks and the laughter. Karen soon wondered how on earth she had ever managed to live away from Copenhagen. One day Karen ran down her street, up the stairs and threw open the apartment door. She flung her arms about Og, who was trying to read his newspaper.
Daddy, Daddy, Daddy!
She pulled him from his seat and began to waltz around the room. Then she left him standing, dazed, in the center of the floor, and began dancing over the furniture and back to him, and threw her arms around him again. Meta appeared in the doorway and smiled.
Your daughter is trying to tell you that she has been accepted by the Royal Ballet.
Well now, Og said. That is pretty good. That night, after Karen was asleep, Meta could at last pour out her pride to Og.
They said she is one in a thousand. With 5 or 6 years of intensive training, she can go right to the top.
That is good. That is good, Og said, trying not to show how very proud he was. But not everything was fairylands and happiness in Copenhagen. Each night the earth was rocked by explosions caused by the underground, explosions that lit the skies, and dancing flames, and the sounds of cracking rifles and stuttering machine guns filled the air. Sabotage. Reprisal. The hippos began methodically to destroy places and things that were sources of pleasure for the Danes. The German-sponsored Danish terrorists blew up theaters and breweries and entertainment palaces. The Danish underground lashed back at places where the German war machine was being fed. Soon both the days and the nights were racked by the thunder of destruction and flying debris. The streets were emptied during German parades. Danes turned their backs on German ceremony. The streets were mobbed by silent mourners on every Danish national holiday. The daily horseback rides of the old king became a signal for hundreds upon hundreds of Danes to rally and run behind him, shouting and cheering. The situation seethed and seethed, and finally erupted. The morning of August 29th, 1943, was ushered in with a blast heard across Zealand. The Danish fleet had scuttled itself in an effort to block the shipping channels. The enraged Germans moved their forces on the government buildings and royal palace at Amalienborg. The King's Guard fought them off. A furious pitched battle broke out, but it was all over rather quickly. German soldiers replaced the King's Guard at Amalienborg. A score of German field generals, SS and Gestapo officials, descended on Denmark to whip the Danes into line. The Danish Parliament was suspended and a dozen angry decrees invoked. The Model Protectorate was no longer a model, if indeed it ever had been. The Danes answered the Germans by stepping up their acts of sabotage. Arsenals, factories, ammunition dumps, bridges were blown to bits. The Germans were getting jittery. Danish sabotage was beginning to hurt badly. From German occupation headquarters at the Hotel d'Angleterre came the decree. All Jews must wear a yellow armband with a Star of David. That night, the underground radio transmitted a message to all Danes. From Amalienborg Palace, King Christian has given the following answer to the German command that Jews must wear a Star of David. The king has said that one Dane is exactly the same as the next Dane. He himself will wear the first Star of David, and he expects that every loyal Dane will do the same. The next day in Copenhagen, Almost the entire population wore armbands showing a Star of David. The following day, the Germans rescinded the order. Although Ogg was not active in the underground, the partners of his law firm were leading members, and from time to time he received information of their activities. At the end of the summer of 1943, he became terribly worried and decided that he and Mehta must reach a decision concerning Karen. "It is true," Ogg told his wife. "In a matter of months, the Germans will round up all the Jews. We just don't know the exact time the Gestapo will strike." Mehta Hansen walked to the window and stared blankly down at the lake and the bridge to the old town. It was evening, and soon Karen would be coming home from ballet school. Mehta's mind had been filled with many things she had been planning for Karen's 13th birthday party. It was going to be quite a wonderful affair. 40 children at the Tivoli Gardens. Ogg lit his pipe and stared at the picture of Karen on his desk. He sighed.
"I am not giving her up," Mehta said.
"We have no right."
"It is different. She is not a Danish Jew. We have records to show she is our child."
Ogg put his hand on his wife's shoulder. "Someone in Aalborg may inform the Germans."
"They won't go to that trouble for one child."
"Don't you know these people by now?" Mehta turned around.
"We will have her baptized and adopt her legally."
Ogg shook his head slowly. His wife slumped into a chair and bit her lip. She clutched the arms of the chair so tightly her hand turned white.
"What will happen, Ogg?"
"They are organizing to get all the Jewish people up to the Zealand beaches near the Straits. We are purchasing as many boats as we can to make runs over to Sweden. The Swedes have sent word that they will accept everyone and provide for them."
"How many nights I have lain awake and thought of this? I have tried to tell myself that she is in greater danger if she must flee. I tell myself over and over that she is safer here with us."
"Think of what you are saying, Mehta." The woman looked at her husband with an expression of anguish and determination he had never seen from her before.
"I will never give her up, Ogg. I cannot live without her."
Every Dane who was called upon cooperated in a gigantic effort. The entire Jewish population of Denmark was whisked secretly north to Zealand and smuggled to the safety of Sweden. Later that month, the Germans made a sweep of Denmark to catch the Jews. There were none to be caught. Although Karen remained unharmed in Copenhagen with the Hansens, the responsibility of the decision weighed heavily on Mehta. From that second on, the German occupation became a prolonged nightmare. A dozen new rumors would send her into a panic. 3 or 4 times she fled from Copenhagen with Karen to relatives on Jutland. Ogg became more and more active in the underground. He was gone 3 or 4 nights a week now. These nights were long and horrible for Mehta. The Danish underground, now directed and coordinated, turned its energies against German transportation. Every half hour, a rail line was bombed. Soon the entire rail network of the country was littered with the wreckage of blasted trains. The hippos took their revenge by blowing up the beloved Tivoli Gardens. The Danes called a general strike against the Germans. They poured into the streets and set up barricades all over Copenhagen, flying Danish, American, British, and Russian flags. The Germans declared Copenhagen in a state of siege. From German headquarters at the Hotel d'Angleterre, Dr. Werner Best shrieked in fury, "The rabble of Copenhagen shall taste the whip!" The general strike was beaten down, but the underground kept up its acts of destruction. September 19th, 1944. The Germans interned the entire Danish police force for failing to control the people and for overt sympathy with their actions against the occupation forces. The underground, in a daring raid, destroyed the Nazi record offices. The underground manufactured small arms and smuggled fighters into Sweden to join Danish free forces. It turned its wrath on the Hippos, dispensing quick justice to some of its members and to Danish traitors. The Hippos and the Gestapo went berserk in an aimless wave of reprisal murders. Then German refugees began pouring over the border into Denmark. These were people bombed out by the Allies. They swarmed all over the country, taking food and shelter without asking, stealing and preying on the Danes. The Danes turned their backs on these refugees with utter contempt. In April 1945, there were all sorts of rumors. May 4th, 1945.
Mommy! Daddy! The war is over! The war is over!
Chapter 13. The victors entered Denmark, the Yanks and the British and the Danish Free Forces. It was a great week. A week of retribution to the Hippos and the Danish traitors, to Dr. Werner Best and the Gestapo. A week of din and delirious joy, climaxed by the appearance of creaking old King Christian to reopen the Danish Parliament. He spoke in a proud but tired voice, which broke with emotion. For Meta and Arg Hansen, the week of the liberation was a time of sorrow. 7 years before, they had rescued a child from grave danger, and they had raised her into a blossoming young woman. What a lovely girl she was. Karen was grace and beauty and laughter. Her voice was pure and sweet, and she danced with magic wings on her feet. Now, the day of judgment. Once, in a fit of anguish, Meta Hansen had sworn she would never give Karen up. Now, Meta Hansen was becoming a victim of her own decency. There were no Germans left to fight now, only her own Christian goodness, and Ark would fall victim, as he had to his Danish sense of honor. Liberation brought upon them a fear of the haunted nights and the life of emptiness that lay ahead of them without Karen. The Hansens had aged badly during the last 7 years. It was apparent the moment they were allowed to relax from the tension of war. No matter how trying things had been, there had always been room for laughter. But now, while Denmark laughed, there was no laughter for them. The Hansens wanted only to look at Karen, hear her voice, spend the hours in her room in a desperate attempt to gather for themselves a lifetime of memories. Karen knew it was coming. She loved the Hansens. Og had always done what was right. She had to wait for him to speak first. For 2 weeks after the liberation, the gloom thickened. At last, one evening after another wordless meal, Og rose from the table and put down his napkin. His kindly face was wrinkled, and his voice a listless monotone. "We must try to find your parents, Karen. It is the thing to do." He walked from the room quickly. Karen looked to the empty doorway, and then to Meta across the table.
"I love you," Karen said,
and ran to her room and threw herself on the bed and sobbed, hating herself for bringing this sorrow on them. And now she was hating herself for another reason. She wanted to learn about her past. In a few more days, they sought out the International Refugee Organization. "This is my foster daughter," Og said. The caseworker had been on her job only the few weeks since the liberation, but already she was becoming sick at the sight of couples like the Hansens and Karen. Day after day, the woman was being forced to become a party to tragedy. In Denmark and Holland, in Sweden and Belgium and France, couples like the Hansens, who had hidden and sheltered and raised children, were now stepping forward to receive their bitter reward.
"You must be prepared for a long and difficult task. There are millions of displaced people in Europe. We have absolutely no idea how long it is going to take to reunite families."
They left with her all the known facts. a list of all the known relatives, and the letters. Karen had a large family, and her father had been a prominent man. The woman gave them a little hope. A week passed, and two, and then three. June, July. Months of torture for Og and Meta. They would stand in the doorway of Karen's room more and more often. It was frilly and soft, and it smelled good. There were her ice skates and her ballet slippers, and pictures of classmates and prima ballerinas. There was a picture of her beau, the Peterson boy. At last, they were called to the refugee organization.
"We are faced with the fact," the woman said, "that all our initial inquiries have turned up nothing. This is not to be taken as conclusive. It means a long, hard task. Were it my own decision, I would absolutely forbid Karen to travel to Germany alone, or even with Mr. Hansen. There is utter chaos inside Germany, and you won't find a thing that we can't do from here."
The woman looked squarely at the three of them.
"I must warn you about one thing. We have been receiving more and more reports each day that something pretty hideous has happened. Many Jews have been put to death. It is beginning to look as though the numbers may run into the millions."
It was another reprieve for the Hansens. But what a ghastly thought. Were they to keep this girl only because over 50 members of her immediate family had been put to death? The Hansens were being pulled in two directions. The solution came from Karen herself. Despite the love she had given and received from the Hansens, there had always been a strange, invisible barrier between them. Early in the German occupation, when she was but 8 years old, Og had told her she must never speak about being Jewish, because it could endanger her life. Karen followed this order, as she did all of Og's decisions, because she loved him and trusted him. But even though she obeyed it, she could not keep from wondering why she was different from other people, and exactly what this difference was that endangered her very life. It was a question she could never ask, and therefore it was never answered. Furthermore, Karen had been completely isolated from any contact with Jews. She felt herself to be like other people, and she looked like other people. Yet the invisible barrier was there. Her question might well have died, but Og and Meta kept it alive inadvertently. The Hansens were faithful to the traditions of the Danish Lutheran Church and were very devout. Each Sunday the three of them went to church together, and each night before bedtime, Og read from the Book of Psalms. Karen treasured the little white leather Bible the Hansens gave her on her 10th birthday, and she loved the magnificent fairy-like stories, especially those in Judges and Samuel and Kings, which were filled with all the wonderment of great loves and wars and passions. Reading the Bible was like reading Hans Christian Andersen himself. But reading the Bible only led to confusion for Karen. So many times she wanted to talk it all over with Og. Jesus was born one of these Jews, and his mother and all his disciples were Jews. The first part of the Bible, the most fascinating to Karen's mind, was all about Jews. Didn't it say over and over again that the Jews were people chosen by God himself to carry out his laws? If this was all true, then why was it so dangerous to be Jewish? And why were the Jews hated so? Karen probed deeper as she grew older. She read that God often punished the Jews when they were bad. Had they been very bad? Karen was a naturally curious girl, and so long as these questions arose, she became more and more perplexed by them. The Bible became her secret obsession. In the quiet of her room, she studied its passages in the hope of finding some answers to the great riddle. The more she read, the older she became, the more puzzled she was. By the time she was 14, she was able to reason out many of the passages and their meanings. Almost everything that Jesus taught, all his ideas, had been set down before in the Old Testament. Then came the largest riddle of all. If Jesus were to return to the earth, she was certain he would go to a synagogue rather than a church. Why could people worship Jesus and hate his people? Another thing happened on her 14th birthday. At that age, Danish girls are confirmed in the church with a great deal of ceremony and celebration. Karen had lived as a Dane and a Christian, yet the Hansons hesitated in the matter of her confirmation. They talked it over and felt that they could not take upon themselves a matter that had been decided by God. They told Karen the confirmation would be set aside because of the war and the uncertainty of the times. But Karen knew the real reason. When she had first come to the Hansons, she had needed love and shelter. Now her needs had expanded into a longing for identification. The mystery of her family and her past ran parallel with this mystery of being Jewish. In order to take her place forever as a Dane, she had to close the door on these burning questions. She was unable to do so. Her life was based on something temporary, an invisible wall. Her past and her religion always stood between her and the Hansons. As the war drew to a close, Karen knew that she would be torn from them. Wisely, she conditioned herself to the shock of the inevitable parting. Being Karen Hansen was merely playing a game. She made the need of becoming Karen Clement urgent. She tried to reconstruct threads of her past life, to remember her father, her mother, and her brothers. Pieces and snatches came back to her in dim and disconnected hazes. She pretended over and over again how the reunion with them would be. She made her longing constant. By the time the war was over, Karen had conditioned herself completely. One night, a few months after the end of the war, she told the Hansons that she was going away to find her parents. She told them she had seen the woman at the refugee organization, and her chances of finding her family would be better if she moved to a displaced persons camp in Sweden. Actually, the chances were the same if she stayed, but she could not bear to prolong the Hansons' agony. Karen cried for Og and Mette far more than for herself. With promises to write and with the slim hope of another reunion with them, Karen Hansen Clement, aged 14, cast herself adrift in the stream of rumors of the backwash of war. Chapter 14. The dream was ruthless to the reality. The first month away from Denmark was a nightmare. She was frightened, for she had always been sheltered, but a dogged determination carried her on. First to a camp in Sweden, and then to a chateau in Belgium, where there were armies of homeless, penniless drifters, inmates of concentration camps, those who fled and those who hid and were hidden, and those who fought in the hills and forests as partisans, and those legions of forced labor. Each day was riddled with rumors and new stories of horror. Each day brought a succession of new shocks to Karen. 25 million people lay dead in the wake of war. The trail led to the displaced persons camp, La Ciotat, on the Gulf of Lions in southern France, a few miles from Marseille. La Ciotat seemed a morbid place, packed with lusterless concrete block barracks which seemed to slosh in a never-ending sea of mud. The numbers of refugees multiplied daily. It was overcrowded, short of everything, and the specter of death seemed to haunt the inmates. To them, all Europe had become a coffin. Genocide. A dance of death with 6 million dancers. Karen heard the names of Frank and Müller and Himmler and Rosenberg and Stryker and Kaltenbrunner and Heydrich. She heard the names of thousands of lesser ones, Ilse Koch, who won infamy by making lampshades out of human tattooed skins, and of Dita Visliceni, who played the role of stockyard goat leading the sheep to slaughter, or Kramer, who sported in horsewhipping naked women and some of whose handiwork she saw. The name of the greatest killer of them all came up over and over again. Eichmann, the German-Palestinian who spoke fluent Hebrew and was the master of genocide. Karen rued the day she had opened that secret door marked Jew, for behind it lay death. One by one, the death of an aunt or uncle or cousin was confirmed. Genocide, carried out with the precision and finality of a machine. At first, the efforts of the Germans had been clumsy. They killed by rifle. It was too slow. They organized their transport and their scientists for the great effort. Steel-covered trucks were designed to lock in and gas to death prisoners en route to burial grounds. But even the gas vans proved slow. Next came the crematoriums and the gas chambers, capable of killing 2,000 people in a half hour, 10,000 on a good day in a major camp. The organization and planning proved itself, and genocide proceeded on an assembly line basis. And Karen heard of thousands of prisoners who threw themselves on the quick mercy of electrified barbed wire to cheat the gas chambers. And Karen heard of hundreds of thousands who fell to disease and hunger, stacked up emaciated corpses thrown into unmarked ditches, with logs placed between them and gasoline poured over them. And Karen heard of the game of deception that was played to tear children away from their mothers under the guise of resettlement, and of trains packed with the old and feeble. Karen heard of the delousing chambers where prisoners were given bars of soap. The chambers were gas, and the soap was made of stone. Karen heard of mothers who hid children in their clothing, which was hung up on pegs before going into the chambers. But the Germans knew the ruse, and always found the little ones. Karen heard of thousands who knelt naked beside graves they had dug, fathers holding their hands over the eyes of their sons as German pistols went off in the backs of their heads. She heard of SS Hauptsturmführer Fritz Gebauer, who specialized in strangling women and children barehanded, and who liked watching infants die in barrels of freezing water. She heard of Heinen, who perfected a method of killing several people in a row with one bullet, always trying to beat his previous record. She heard of Frank Warzok, who liked to bet on how long a human could live, hanging by the feet. She heard of Obersturmbannführer Rokita, who ripped bodies apart. She heard of Steiner, who bored holes into prisoners' heads and stomachs and pulled fingernails and gouged eyes and liked to swing naked women from poles by their hair. She heard of General Franz Jacon, who conducted the massacre of Babi Yar. Babi Yar was a suburb of Kiev, and in 2 days, 33,000 Jews were rounded up and shot, to the approval of many cheering Ukrainians. She heard of Professor Hertz's Anatomical Institute at Strasbourg and of his scientists, and she saw evidences of the deformed women who had been subjects of their experiments. Dachau was the biggest of the scientific centers. She learned that Dr. Heiskayer injected children with TB germs and observed their death. Dr. Schutz was interested in blood poisoning. Dr. Rascher wanted to save the lives of German air crews, and in his experiments, high-altitude conditions were simulated and human guinea pigs frozen to death while they were carefully observed through special windows. There were other experiments in what the Germans referred to as truth in science, which reached a peak, perhaps, in the attempted implantation of animal sperm in human females. Karen heard of Vilhaus, the commander of the camp at Janowska, who commissioned the composer Mundt to write the Death Tango. The notes of this song were the last sounds heard by 200,000 Jews who were liquidated at Janowska. She heard other things about Vilhaus at Janowska. She heard his hobby was throwing infants into the air and seeing how many bullets he could fire into the body before it reached the ground. His wife, Ottilie, was also an excellent shot. Karen heard about the Lithuanian guards of the Germans who merely clubbed and kicked people to death, and of the Croatian Ustashes and their violent killings of hundreds of thousands of prisoners, too. Karen wept, and she was dazed, and she was haunted. Her nights were sleepless, and the names of the land tore through her brain. Had her father and mother and brothers been sent to Buchenwald? Or had they met death in the horror of Dachau? Maybe it was Chełmno with 1 million dead, or Maidenek with 750,000, or Belzec, or Treblinka with its lines of vans, or Sobibor, or Travniki, or Poniatov, or Krivoy Roh. Had they been shot in the pits of Krasnik, or burned at the stake at Kluga, or torn apart by dogs at Dziedzin, or tortured to death at Stutthof? The lash, the ice bath, the electric shock, the soldering iron. Genocide. Was it the camp at Choiseul, or Dora, or Neuengamme? Or was it at Gross Rosen? Or did they hear Vilhaus's death tango at Janowska? Was her family among the bodies which were melted to fat in the manufacture of soap at Danzig? Death lingered on and on at the displaced persons camp at La Ciotat near Marseille, France. And Karen heard more names of the land. Danagien, Ivari, Goldpilz, Vivara, Portkunde. She could not eat, and she could not sleep. Kivioli, Varva, Magdeburg, Plaszów, Szebnia, Mauthausen, Sachsenhausen, Oranienburg, Landsberg, Bergen-Belsen, Reinsdorf, Bliźnie. Genocide. Fossenberg, Ravensbrück, Natzweiler. But all these names were small beside the greatest of them all, Auschwitz. Auschwitz with its 3 million dead. Auschwitz with its warehouses crammed with eyeglasses. Auschwitz with its warehouses crammed with boots and clothing and pitiful rag dolls. Auschwitz with its warehouse of human hair for the manufacture of mattresses. Auschwitz where the gold teeth of the dead were methodically pulled and melted down for shipment to Himmler's Science Institute. Auschwitz, where an especially finely shaped skull would be preserved as a paperweight. Auschwitz, where the bones of the cremated were broken up with sledgehammers and pulverized so that there would never be a trace of death. Auschwitz, which had the sign over the main entrance, Labor Liberates. Karen Hansen Clement sank deep in melancholy. She heard till she could hear no more. She saw until she could see no more. She was exhausted and confused, and the will to go on was being drained from her blood. Then, as so often happens when one reaches the end of the line, there was a turning upward, and she emerged into the light. It began when she smiled and patted the head of an orphan, and the child sensed great compassion in her. Karen was able to give children what they craved the most, tenderness. They flocked to her. She seemed to know instinctively how to dry a runny nose, kiss a wounded finger, or soothe a tear, and she could tell stories and sing at the piano in many languages. She plunged into her work with the younger children with a fervor that helped her forget a little of the pain within her. She never seemed to run out of patience nor of time for giving. Her 15th birthday came and went at La Ciotat. Aside from the fact that she was just plain stubborn, Karen clung to two great hopes. Her father had been a prominent man, and the Germans had kept one prestige camp where prisoners were neither tortured nor killed. It was the camp at Theresienstadt in Czechoslovakia. If he had been sent there, as well he might, he could still be alive. The second hope, a slimmer one, was that many German scientists had been smuggled out of the country even after being sent to concentration camps. Against these hopes, she had the confirmed deaths of over half of her family. One day, several dozen new people entered the camp, and the place seemed to transform overnight. The new people were Palestinians from the Mossad Aliyah Bet and the Palmach, who had come to take over the interior organization. A few days after they arrived, Karen danced for her youngsters, the first time she had danced since the summer. From that moment on, she was in constant demand and one of the most popular figures in La Ciotat. Her renown spread even as far as Marseille, where she was invited to dance in an annual Christmas presentation of the Nutcracker Suite. Christmas, 1945. The pangs of loneliness of her first Christmas away from the Hansons were terrible. Half the children in La Ciotat had come to Marseille to watch her dance in a special performance. Karen danced that night as she had never danced before. When the performance was over, a Palestinian Palmach girl named Galil, who was the section head at La Ciotat, asked Karen to wait until everyone had left. Tears streamed down Galil's cheeks.
"Karen, we have just received positive confirmation that your mother and your two brothers were exterminated at Dachau."
Karen tumbled into a sorrow even deeper than before. The undaunted spirit which had kept her going vanished. She felt the curse of being born a Jewess had led her to the madness of leaving Denmark. Every child in La Ciotat had one thing in common. Every one of them believed their parents were alive. All of them waited for the miracle which never came. What a fool she had been to believe. When she was able to come to her senses several days later, she talked it all over with Galil. She did not feel she had the strength to sit and wait until she heard that her father was dead also. Galil, the Palestine girl, was her only confidant and felt that Karen, like all Jews, should go to Palestine. It was the only place a Jew could live with dignity, Galil argued. But, with her faith destroyed, Karen was about ready to close the door on Judaism, for it had brought her only misery and left her as Karen Hansen, a Dane. At night, Karen asked herself the same question that every Jew had asked of himself since the temple in Jerusalem had been destroyed and the Jews were dispersed to the four corners of the earth as eternal drifters 2,000 years before. Karen asked herself,
"Why me?"
Each day brought her closer to that moment when she would write the Hansons and ask to return to them forever. Then one morning, Galil rushed into Karen's barrack and half-dragged her to the administration building, where she was introduced to a Dr. Brenner, a new refugee at La Ciotat.
"Oh, God!"
Karen cried as she heard the news.
"Are you certain?"
"Yes," Brenner answered. "I am absolutely positive. You see, I knew your father in the old days. I was a teacher in Berlin. We often exchanged correspondence and met at conventions."
"Yes, my dear. We were in Theresienstadt together, and I saw him last only a few weeks before the war ended."
Chapter 15. A week later, Karen received a letter from the Hansons stating that there had been inquiries from the refugee organization as to her whereabouts, as well as questions as to whether the Hansons had any information about her mother or brothers. It was assumed that the inquiries came from Johann Clement, or from someone in his behalf. Karen surmised from this that her father and mother had been separated, and he was unaware of her death and the death of the brothers. The next letter from the Hansons stated that they had replied, but the refugee organization had lost contact with Clement. But he was alive. Every horrible moment of the months in the camps in Sweden, Belgium, and La Ciotat was worth it now. Once again, she found the courage to search for her past. Karen wondered why La Ciotat was being supported by money from Jews in America. After all, there was everything in the camp but Americans. She asked Galil, who shrugged. Zionism is a first person asking money from a second person to give to a third person to send a fourth person to Palestine.
It is good, Karen said, that we have friends who stick together.
We also have enemies who stick together, Galil answered.
The people at La Ciotat certainly looked and acted much like any other people, Karen thought. Most of them seemed just as confused by being Jewish as she was. When she had learned enough Hebrew to handle herself, she ventured into the religious compound to observe the weird rituals, the dress and prayer of those people who were truly different. The vastness of the sea of Judaism can drown a girl of 15. The religion was based on a complex set of laws. Some were written and some were oral. They covered the most minute of subjects, such as how to pray on a camel. The holiest of the holy were the 5 books of Moses, the Torah. Once again, Karen turned to her Bible. This time, what she read seemed to throw new light and have new meaning for her, and she would think for hours about lines like the cry of the prophet Isaiah, "We grope for the wall like the blind, and we grope as if we had no eyes. We stumble at noonday as in the night. We are in desolate places as dead men. We roar like bears and mourn sore like doves. We look for salvation, but it is far off from us." These words seemed to fit the situation at La Ciotat. Her Bible was filled with stories of bondage and freedom, and she tried to apply these things to herself and her family. "Look from heaven and see how we have become a scorn and a derision among the nations. We are accounted as sheep and brought to the slaughter to be slain and destroyed or to be smitten and reproached. Yet despite all this, we have not forgotten thy name. We beseech thee, forget us not." And again the path would end in confusion. Why would God let 6 million of his people be killed? Karen concluded that only the experiences of life would bring her the answer, someday. The inmates of La Ciotat seethed with a terrible desire to leave Europe behind them and get to Palestine. The only force that kept them from turning into a wild mob was the presence of the Palmachniks from Palestine. They cared little about the war of intrigue that raged about them between the British and the Mossad Aliyah Bet. They did not care about British desperation to hold on to the Middle East, or oil, or canals, or traditional cooperation with the Arabs. For a brief instant, a year earlier, everyone's hopes had soared as the Labour Party swept into power, and with it promises to turn Palestine into a model mandate with open immigration. Talk was even revived of making Palestine a member of the British Commonwealth. The promises exploded as the Labour government listened to the voice of black gold that bubbled beneath Arab sand. The decisions were delayed for more study, more commissions, more talk, as it had been for 25 years. But nothing could curb the craving of the Jews in La Ciotat to get to Palestine. Mossad Aliyah Bet agents poured all over Europe looking for Jewish survivors and leading them through friendly borders with bribes, forgery, stealing, or any other means short of force. A gigantic game was played as the scene shifted from one country to another. From the very beginning, France and Italy allied themselves with the refugees in open cooperation with the Mossad. They kept their borders open to receive refugees and to establish camps. Italy, occupied by British troops, was severely hampered, so France became the major refugee center. Soon, places like La Ciotat were bulging. The Mossad answered with illegal immigration. Every seaport of Europe was covered by Mossad agents who used the money sent them by American Jews to purchase and refit boats to run the British blockade into Palestine. The British not only used their navy, but their embassies and consulates as counter-spying centers against the Mossad. Leaky little boats of the Mossad Alia Bet, overloaded with desperate people, set out for Palestine, only to be caught by the British as soon as they entered the three-mile zone. The refugees would be interned in yet another camp, this one in Atlit in Palestine. After Karen learned her father was alive, she too became swept up in the desire to get to Palestine. It seemed natural to her that her father would come to Palestine also. Although she was only 15, she was drawn into the Palmach group, whose members held nightly campfires and told wonderful stories of the land of milk and honey and sang wonderful Oriental songs right out of the Bible. They joked and spun tall yarns all night long, and they would call, "Dance, Karen, dance!" She was made a section chief to take care of 100 children and prepare them for the moment a Mossad boat would take them to run the blockade into Palestine. The British quota for Palestine was only 1,500 a month, and they always took old people or those too young to fight. Men grew beards and grayed their hair to look old, but such ruses usually didn't work. In April of 1946, 9 months after Karen had left Denmark, Galil gave her the great news one day.
"An Alia Bet ship is coming in a few days, and you and your section are going on it."
Karen's heart nearly tore through her dress.
"What is the name of it?"
"The Star of David," Galil answered.
Chapter 16. British CID had a running acquaintance with the Aegean tramp steamer Carpathos. They knew the instant the Carpathos was purchased in Salonika by the Mossad Alia Bet. They followed the movements of the 800-ton, 45-year-old tramp to Piraeus, the port of Athens, where an American Alia Bet crew boarded her and sailed her to Genoa, Italy. They observed as the Carpathos was refitted into an immigrant runner, and they knew the exact instant she left and sailed toward the Gulf of Lions. The entire southern coast of France was alive with CID men. A 24-hour watch was thrown around La Ciotat for signs of a large-scale movement. A dozen major and minor French officials were bribed. Pressure came from Whitehall to Paris to prevent the Carpathos from getting inside French territorial waters. But British pressure and bribes had no effect. French cooperation with Alia Bet remained solid. The Carpathos moved inside the three-mile zone. The next stage of the game was set. A half-dozen trial runs were made from La Ciotat to trick and divert the British. Trucks were donated by the French teamsters and driven by French drivers. When the British were thoroughly confused, the real break was made. 1,600 refugees, Karen's section included, were sped out from La Ciotat to a secret rendezvous point along the coast. The entire area was blocked off from outside traffic by the French army. The trucks unloaded the refugees on a quiet beach, and they were transferred by rubber boats to the ancient Carpathos, which waited offshore. The line of rubber boats moved back and forth all night. The strong hands of the American crew lifted the anxious escapees aboard. Palmach teams on board quickly moved each boatload to a pre-designated section. A knapsack, a bottle of water, and an obsession to leave Europe was all the refugees had. Karen's children, the youngest, were boarded first and given a special position in the hold. They were placed below deck near the ladder which ran to the deck. She worked quickly to calm them down. Fortunately, most of them were too numbed with excitement and exhaustion and fell right off to sleep. A few cried, but she was right there to comfort them. An hour passed, and two, and three, and the hold began to get crowded. On came the refugees until the hold was so packed there was scarcely an inch to move in any direction. Then they began filling up the deck space topside, and when that was crammed, they flooded over onto the bridge. Bill Fry, an American and captain of the ship, came down the ladder and looked over the crush of humanity in the hold and whistled. He was a stocky man with a stubbly beard and an unlit cigar butt clenched between his teeth.
"You know, the Boston Fire Department would raise hell if they ever saw a room like this," Bill mumbled.
He stopped talking and began to listen. From the shadows, a very sweet voice was singing a lullaby. He pushed his way down the ladder and stepped over the bodies and turned a flashlight on Karen, who was holding a little boy in her arms and singing him to sleep. For an instant, he thought he was looking at the Madonna. He blinked his eyes. Karen looked up and motioned him to take the flashlight off her.
"Hey, kid, you speak English?"
Bill's gruff voice said.
"Yes."
"Where is the section head of these kids?"
"I am the section head, and I'll thank you to lower your voice. I've had enough trouble getting them quieted down."
"I'll talk as loud as I want. I'm the captain. You ain't no bigger than most of these kids."
"If you run your ship as well as I run this section," Karen snapped angrily, "then we will be in Palestine by morning."
He scratched his bearded jaw and smiled. He certainly didn't look like the dignified Danish ship's captains, Karen thought, and he was only pretending to be hard.
"You're a nice kid. If you need something, you come up on the bridge and see me. And you be more respectful."
"Thank you, Captain."
"That's all right. Just call me Bill. We're all from the same tribe."
Karen watched as he climbed the ladder, and she could see the first crack of daylight. The Carpathos was crammed with as many people as she could hold, 1,600 refugees hanging from every inch of her. The half-rusted anchor creaked up and slapped against the sides of her wooden hulk. The 45-year-old engines coughed and sputtered and reluctantly churned into action. A fog